Okay, well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I want to talk for a while tonight about the abolitionist movement. We are here near where John Brown had his farm. We're near where other abolitionists were active before the Civil War. And what I wanted to do is talk for a while about the abolitionists and what they contributed to American ideas about freedom. One of my more recent books is called The Story of American Freedom, and it traces out this sort of tangled and complicated history of the idea of freedom from the American Revolution all the way up almost to the present. Now, I think you'll all agree that no idea is more central or fundamental to our sense of ourselves as Americans as freedom. This is the central word in our political language, and I should say freedom and liberty. I use those kind of interchangeably as they have been used interchangeably throughout American history. These words are embedded in the record of our history and in our everyday lives. The Declaration of Independence lists liberty as one of the inalienable rights of mankind. The Constitution says that its purpose is to secure the blessings of liberty. Many of our wars have been fought in the name of freedom in one form or another. The Civil War, said Lincoln, was to produce a new birth of freedom. World War II was fought for the four freedoms. The current war, according to our president, is called enduring freedom. So freedom has often been used to mobilize people in times of crisis and for national unity. Our love of liberty has been represented by liberty poles, liberty caps, statues of liberty. It's been acted out by burning stamps and burning draft cards, by running away from slavery, and by demonstrating for the right to vote. But the main point of my book, which I'm not going to reiterate here in any great length, is that despite, and maybe because of the ubiquitousness of the idea of liberty and freedom, these ideas have not had a single kind of predetermined meaning throughout American history. Freedom is not a timeless idea, nor is it an evolutionary narrative toward a preordained goal. Freedom is what philosophers call an essentially contested concept. There are many different ideas of freedom out there. Use of the idea of freedom automatically presupposes an encounter, a dialogue with other competing meanings of freedom. And the ways in which the meaning of freedom have been constructed and changed many times in American history, which is really what my book is about, are very complicated. Too often, if we read the traditional American history works, it's the story of Supreme Court decisions, laws, presidential proclamations. But freedom has also been created on plantations, on picket lines, and even in people's bedrooms. And the most dynamic element in struggles in the expansion of the idea of freedom in American history have been the struggles of people who feel that they are deprived of liberty to gain freedom as they understand it. And those struggles have actually expanded the meaning of liberty and changed the meaning of liberty for all Americans. And what I want to do tonight is to, as I said, talk about the central role that the abolitionist movement before the Civil War played in redefining freedom in 19th century America and in creating many of the elements of freedom as an idea and as a practice that we kind of take for granted today. Now, before doing that, though, let me just remind you that the abolitionist movement was a small, beleaguered group of men and women. After the Civil War, everybody claimed to have been an abolitionist. You look at people running for office in the 1870s and 80s, their little campaign biographies, they were all members of the abolitionist movement. There were so many abolitionists, it's amazing slavery survived at all. But before the Civil War, abolitionists were a small group, There was a much larger group of people, like Abraham Lincoln, for example, who was an opponent of slavery but was not an abolitionist, who opposed the expansion of slavery into the West but did not call for its eradication in the states where it existed. This small group of abolitionists confronted enormous barriers. Again, the destruction of slavery is so, seems to us such an inevitable consequence of just progress in 19th century America that we may not reflect enough on the barriers to the ending of slavery, what the abolitionists were up against. And just a few of those barriers were as follows. First of all, slavery was embedded in the Constitution. The Constitution contained several clauses which explicitly protected and strengthened the institution of slavery, most notably the Fugitive Slave Clause and the Three-Fifths Clause, which gave the Southern states extra power in the political system. Slavery was the most important economic institution in the United States before the Civil War. That's another thing that we may not quite realize, the economic centrality of slavery. And I'm not just talking in the South. Millions of people in the North's livelihoods rested on their connection with slavery, whether it's people working in cotton textile mills, merchants, sailors, dock workers, insurance companies, bankers who financed, shipped, profited from the products of slave labor. In 1860, the census of 1860 revealed that if you look at slaves as an economic investment, which they were as well as being human beings, the 4 million slaves in the South represented an investment of $4 billion. Now that's 1860 billion dollars. That's hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars in today's money. The total value of all the factories, railroads, and banks in the United States in 1860 did not add up to $4 billion. Slaves represented a greater concentration of property than all the banks, factories, and railroads put together. That's what I say, that slavery was a pretty powerful economic institution. Racism was deeply embedded in American society, North as well as South. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But the widespread belief in the innate inferiority of African-American people was another great barrier to support for the notion of abolishing slavery. Those before the rise of the abolitionist movement, which we generally date from the late 1820s, early 1830s, before the rise of the abolitionist movement, there was another large anti-slavery organization known as the Colonization Society. Its program was that the slaves should be freed and deported to Africa, that this was a country that could not exist as a biracial society. Colonization was the mainstream political approach to the slavery issue. You name a major political leader of the early to mid-19th century, they were in the Colonization Society. Jefferson believed in colonization. James Madison, James Monroe, Andrew Jackson, John Marshall, Henry Clay, Daniel Webster. You just give me the names of the leading figures of the Jackson era. They're most likely in the colonization. Abraham Lincoln was a strong supporter of colonization before the Civil War. So this was the mainstream approach. It was vaguely anti-slavery, but it rejected the idea that slaves could be freed and actually remain as citizens, as members of American society. The other point that's important to note is that in the first 3 or 4 decades of the 19th century, racism became more and more deeply embedded in American life. Because slavery was such a powerful presence in the society, how could a society which prided itself on democracy, on belief in equality, belief in opportunity for all, how could it also countenance Slavery. Well, racism became the explanation for that. Racism is the way of squaring the circle of a country which claims to be an empire of liberty, in Jefferson's terminology, and yet harbors the largest slave system the world has ever known. The reason is, why are blacks excluded from the liberty? Because they are innately incapable of living in, as free persons. John Stuart Mill, the great British writer of this period, the mid-19th century, said, "Was there ever any domination which did not appear natural to those who possess it?" And this is a very shrewd comment. Domination has to be made to appear natural, and one of the ways that it is made to appear natural is to blame it on nature, literally speaking. Nature had created this racial barrier. Nature had created differences between different groups of people, and slavery was the inevitable consequence of that. And blacks, of course, were not the only group that were considered innately inferior. "How did woman first become subject to man?" asked the New York Herald. "By her nature," it answered. "By her nature, just as the Negro is and always will be inferior to the white race and therefore doomed to subjection." That's the New York Herald. That's not the Charleston Mercury or the New Orleans. That is New York, a mainstream newspaper of New York City in 1852. And as the 19th century develops, American democracy itself takes on a greater and greater racial definition. It's sometimes forgotten that at the time of the American Revolution, free African Americans, there weren't a heck of a lot of them, men, could vote in most of the states. In most of the original 13 states, black men could vote if they could meet the property qualification. There were property qualifications applying to everybody. Most African Americans couldn't meet them, but there was no racial barrier. If a black person acquired property, they could vote. That was even true in states like North Carolina early on. As late as 1800, no northern state limited the right to vote because of race. But after that, with the single exception of Maine, every state that entered the Union, starting with Ohio in 1803, included the word white in its state constitution when it mentioned voting qualifications. And in states like New York and Pennsylvania, the right to vote was either taken away entirely, as it was in Pennsylvania in 1837, or severely limited. In New York in 1821, in the Constitution here, the property qualification was eliminated for whites, but raised for blacks to land worth $250, which was an extremely high threshold at that time. As the exhibition shows, that is why the abolitionist Gerrit Smith, one of his motivations in giving land to a large group of African Americans up in this vicinity so that they would be able to meet the property qualification and be voters. By 1857, in the famous or infamous Dred Scott decision, the Supreme Court declared that no black person could be a citizen of the United States. Whether free or slave, whether their ancestors have been here for generations, citizenship, American nationality, being an American was only for white persons. So what happens is, you might say, race replaces class as the boundary of who is truly going to be a citizen and who isn't, because the property qualifications disappear, but the racial qualifications become more and more impenetrable. So this is the situation that the abolitionists are facing. They're up against a culture and an economic and political system in which slavery is a powerful part, even for many Northerners. The struggle over slavery, which is launched, when I say the abolitionist movement begins in the late 1820s, early 1830s, there were people criticizing slavery before then. But what's new in this period is, first of all, the emergence of organized groups devoted to the immediate abolition of slavery, and also devoted to incorporating blacks as members of the society. In other words, they attack slavery, they also attack colonization. Once freed, African Americans will remain here as citizens, not be shipped off to some foreign place. The first real expression of this, what we call militant abolitionism, came in 1829 with the publication of a pamphlet in Boston by a free black man called David Walker. David Walker's appeal, which raises these what I call these new abolitionist positions. But Walker dies shortly thereafter. He publishes this dramatic pamphlet, but he doesn't start a movement. In 1831, we get the William Lloyd Garrison begins publication of his weekly newspaper in Boston, The Liberator, which lasts to 1865 and becomes the most prominent mouthpiece for the abolitionist movement. And shortly thereafter, the American Anti-Slavery Society is founded as an organized institution to press these two issues of abolition, immediate abolition, not gradual abolition, but immediate abolition and the incorporation of African Americans as members of the society. The abolitionist movement gave new meaning to many elements of the idea of freedom. One way they did that was by elevating freedom of speech to a central part of the idea of American liberty. The abolitionists were met with riotous hostility. Mobs broke up their meetings in many places throughout the North. There were riots in places like New York and Philadelphia and Boston against abolitionists. Elijah P. Lovejoy, an abolitionist editor, was killed by a mob defending his printing press in Alton, Illinois. Martha mentioned very briefly that I have a sort of a sub-career as a curator. I have put together a couple of historical exhibitions, one of which is at the Chicago Historical Society on the pre-Civil War period, and they have the part of the printing press, it's in our exhibit, of Elijah P. Lovejoy, which was dredged out of the Mississippi River later on. And it sort of said that when they started dredging the Mississippi to find Lovejoy's printing press, they actually found quite a few printing presses. It was sort of normal out there to chuck the press into the river if you didn't like what the guy was printing. So it took a while to figure out which one was actually Lovejoy's press as opposed to some other guy who they didn't just like. But this is a good example of the fact that freedom of expression was not a widely accepted principle. The Bill of Rights was in the Constitution, but there was no legal, there was no jurisprudence defending the right of dissenters and people with unpopular views to express those views without fear of violence or legal action. It was the abolitionists who put the question of free opinion, as they called it, as a central place, to a central place in the discussion of American freedom. In doing so, they put forward the argument that the existence of slavery threatened the rights of white Americans as well as blacks. White Americans' liberties were being jeopardized by these mobs and this mobilization of power to defend slavery and to prevent criticism of slavery. The abolitionists rejuvenated the Bill of Rights as a fundamental definition of American liberties. And indeed, they claimed that their movement was the genuine American movement because it was the custodian of this much beleaguered principle of freedom of expression.